Jewish War, Book 4. As for the Galileans who had revolted from Rome after the fall of Jotapata, they surrendered once the people of Tarichaea had been defeated, and the Romans took over all the strongholds and cities except Jeshala and the men who held Mount Tabor. Joining these holdouts was Gamala, a city lying across the lake opposite Tarichaea. It belonged to Agrippa's realm, along with Sogain and Seleucia, and all three lay within Gaulonitis. Sogain belonged to the district called Upper Gaulon, Gamala to the Lower. Seleucia stood by Lake Semichonitis. This lake measures 30 stadia in width and 60 in length. Its marshes extend as far as the district of Daphne, a delightful place in every respect, with springs that feed the stream called the Little Jordan, which they send on beneath the Temple of the Golden Calf into the Greater Jordan. Agrippa had won over the people of Sogain and Seleucia to his side, with pledges of good faith at the very outset of the revolt. But Gamala would not come over, trusting in the strength of its position even more than Jotapata had. A rugged ridge descending from a high mountain rises in the middle into a kind of spine, and from that height it stretches forward, dropping away as much in front as behind, so that its shape resembles a camel, hence its name, though the local people do not pronounce the word precisely. Along its flanks and its front it breaks off into impassable ravines. Only at the tail end does it offer any easier going, where it is cut off from the mountain, and even there the inhabitants had rendered it difficult by cutting a trench across it. Built against the steep slope, the houses stood packed one on top of another in extraordinary fashion, and the city, seeming almost to hang in midair, tumbled in upon itself because of the steepness of the slope. It leaned toward the south, and its southern ridge, rising to an immense height, formed the city's citadel. Above it, unwalled, a cliff dropped away into the deepest of ravines. A spring lay within the wall, at the point where the town came to an end. Being a city naturally hard to attack, Joseph fortified it further, strengthening it with tunnels and trenches. Its people, trusting in the natural strength of the site, were bolder than the defenders of Jotapata had been, though far fewer of them were fighting men. And confident in their position, they did not think they needed more, even though the city was crowded with refugees who had fled there for its security. This is why it also held out against the forces Agrippa had sent ahead for the siege, for 7 months. Vespasian now broke camp at Amathus, where he had been encamped before Tiberias. Amathus, translated, means hot springs, for there is in it a spring of hot water good for healing, and marched to Gamala. Given how the city lay, he could not surround it entirely with a ring of guard posts, but he stationed watches at the points where this was possible and occupied the mountain that overlooked the city. When the legions had fortified their camps above it, as was their custom, work began on siege ramps at the tail end of the ridge. The eastern section, where the city's highest tower stood, was assigned to the 15th Legion. The 5th worked opposite the middle of the city, and it was left to fill in the trenches and ravines to the 10th. Meanwhile, King Agrippa approached the walls and tried to open talks with the men stationed there about surrender, but one of the slingers struck him on the right elbow with a stone. He was quickly surrounded and helped away by his own men. But the incident spurred the Romans on to press the siege harder, both from anger on the king's behalf and from fear for themselves, reasoning that men who would leave no extreme of cruelty untried against foreigners and enemies would show no less savagery toward one of their own kinsmen, a man giving them counsel for their own good. The ramps were completed quickly, thanks to the sheer number of hands at work and their practiced skill, and the siege engines were brought up. Chars and Joseph, the two most powerful men in the city, drew up their men-at-arms despite their fear, since they did not suppose they could hold out in the siege for long, given that their water and other supplies would not last. Even so, after rousing their men's spirits, they led them out to the wall, and for a short while beat back those bringing up the engines. But under fire from catapults and stone throwers, they withdrew into the city. The Romans then brought their battering rams up on three sides, shook the wall down, and poured in over the ruins with a great blast of trumpets and clashing of weapons, shouting their war cry as they closed with the defenders. For a while, the townspeople held their ground at the first points of entry, blocking the way forward and stubbornly keeping the Romans back. But overwhelmed by superior numbers pressing in from every side, they were driven back toward the upper part of the city. then turned and fell upon the enemy pursuing them, forcing them back down the slope, and trapped in the narrow, difficult ground, cut them down. The Romans, unable either to fight off the men above them or to force their way forward, their own comrades were pressing in from behind, took refuge on the roofs of the houses nearby, which were low, single-story buildings. But the houses quickly collapsed under the crowding, unable to bear the weight. As one house fell, it brought down several others beneath it, and those in turn brought down others still lower. This destroyed a great many of the Romans, for out of sheer desperation, even as they watched the roofs sagging beneath them, they kept leaping onto them. Many were buried under the debris. Many, trying to escape, were caught by parts of their bodies as they fled. And the dust choked and killed a great many more. The people of Gamala took this for God's own help, and, careless of the harm it also did to them, pressed the attack, driving the enemy back onto the roofs, and as they slid and stumbled in the narrow alleys, kept killing from above any who fell. The ruins supplied them stones enough, and the enemy's own dead supplied them iron. Pulling the swords from the fallen, they used them to finish off men in their death agony. Many, seeing the buildings already collapsing beneath them, threw themselves down and died. And even for those who turned to flee, escape was not easy. For in their ignorance of the streets, and blinded by the thick dust, they could not even recognize one another, and cut each other down or trampled one another underfoot. With difficulty, the Romans found their way to the exits and withdrew from the city. Vespasian, meanwhile, kept staying close to his hard-pressed troops. A terrible anguish had gripped him at seeing the city collapsing on top of his army, and, forgetting his own safety, found himself, without noticing it, drawn little by little to the highest point of the city, where he was left in the very midst of the danger with only a handful of men. For his son Titus was not with him at that moment, having been sent to Mucianus in Syria. To turn and run he judged neither safe nor fitting. So, calling to mind the hardships he had endured from his youth and his own courage, as though seized by some divine inspiration, he locked his men's shields together with his own, body to body and arm to arm, and stood his ground against the battle pouring down on him from above, holding firm without flinching before the mass of the enemy or their missiles. Until the enemy, sensing the almost superhuman steadiness of his spirit, slackened their onset. As their pressure grew weaker, he himself withdrew step by step, never turning his back, until he was clear of the wall. A great many Romans fell in this battle, among them the decurion Ebutius, a man who had proved himself outstandingly brave not only in the engagement in which he fell but on every earlier occasion, and had inflicted great harm on the Jews. A centurion named Gallus, cut off in the confusion with 10 soldiers, slipped into a house, and there, overhearing the people inside talking over dinner about what the town council was planning against the Romans or concerning themselves, he and his men, both he and those with him were Syrians, rose up in the night, cut every one of them down, and with his soldiers made his way safely back to the Romans. Vespasian now set about consoling an army disheartened by an unfamiliar defeat, for they had never before suffered a setback of such magnitude, and even more ashamed at having left their general alone amid the dangers. Of his own danger he said nothing, so as not even to seem to be finding fault with the ordeal. Instead he spoke of the common cause, saying they must bear the nature of war bravely, bearing in mind that victory is never won without bloodshed, and that fortune both takes her toll and stands beside us in turn. After killing so many tens of thousands of Jews, he said, we have paid only a small toll to fate in return. Just as it is crass to be carried away by success, so it is unmanly to cower under reverses, for change comes swiftly in either direction, and the best man is the one who stays level-headed even in success, so that his good spirits hold and he can wrestle his way back from failure. What has happened now came about neither through any weakness on your part nor through any valor on the Jews' side. Rather, the terrain itself is to blame both for their advantage and for our failure. If any of you were to blame anything, it would be the recklessness of your charge. When the enemy fled up to the higher ground, you ought to have held back and not chased danger standing directly above your heads, but instead, once masters of the lower town, drawn out those who had fled upward, little by little, into a safe and stable fight. As it was, in your uncontrolled rush for victory, you neglected your own safety. Recklessness in war and a maddened onrush is not the Roman way. We win everything through experience and discipline. It is the way of barbarians, and it is exactly what defeats the Jews themselves. You must instead call your own courage back to mind and feel anger rather than despair at a setback that was undeserved. Let each man seek the best consolation from his own right hand. That way you will avenge the fallen and punish those who killed them. I myself will try, as I did today, to lead you against the enemy in every battle, and to be the last to withdraw. With words like these, he restored the army's spirits. As for the people of Gamala, their success, coming as it did so unexpectedly and on so great a scale, gave them courage for a short while. But reflecting afterward that they had thereby cut off their own hopes of surrender on terms, and realizing that they had no way of escape, since provisions were already running out, they fell into deep despondency, and their spirits sank. Even so, they did not neglect what they could do for their own safety. The bravest among them manned the breaches in the wall, while the rest held the part still standing, keeping watch. When the Romans reinforced their ramps and made ready to renew the assault, many of the townspeople slipped out of the city by way of ravines too rough for guard posts to be placed, and through underground tunnels. Those who stayed behind, for fear of being caught, wasted away from want, since all the food to be had was gathered up for the men still able to fight. While the people of Gamala endured such sufferings, Vespasian, as a side operation to the siege, turned his attention to the men who held Mount Tabor, which lies midway between the Great Plain and Scythopolis. Its height rises to 30 stadia, and it can barely be climbed even on its northern face. The summit is a plain of 26 stadia, entirely walled around. Joseph had raised this great circuit of walls in just 40 days, supplied from below with both building material and water. For the settlers, there had only rainwater to rely on. Once a great crowd had gathered there, Vespasian sent Placidus with 600 cavalry against it. For him, scaling the mountain was out of the question, so he tried to draw down the majority with offers of pledges and appeals for peace. They came down, but with a counter-scheme of their own. Placidus spoke gently, hoping to catch them out in the open plain, while they came down pretending to be persuaded, meaning to fall upon him off his guard. But Placidus's cunning won out. When the Jews opened the fighting, he feigned flight, and having drawn his pursuers far out onto the plain, he wheeled his cavalry about, routed them, and killed most of them, then cut off the remainder and blocked their way back up the mountain. Some abandoned Tabor and fled toward Jerusalem. The local inhabitants, whose water had by now run out, took pledges of safety and surrendered both the mountain and themselves to Placidus. Meanwhile, at Gamala, the more daring of the defenders managed to slip away in flight, undetected, while the weak died of hunger. The fighting men kept up the resistance until, on the 22nd of the month Hyperbaratius, three soldiers of the 15th Legion crept up during the morning watch to a tower that projected in front of their position and quietly began undermining it. The guards stationed above neither noticed them approaching nor noticed them once they had arrived, for it was night. The soldiers, taking care to avoid noise, rolled out five of the largest stones and slipped clear. The tower suddenly collapsed with a tremendous crash, bringing its guards down with it in the fall. The men on the other watchposts, thrown into confusion, fled, and the Romans killed many who tried to force their way out, among them Joseph, who was struck down and killed by a man's missile as he tried to escape over the broken section of wall. Those in the city who were shaken by the noise ran about in a panic, as though the enemy had already broken in everywhere. Their two chars, who lay sick and under treatment, died, his terror joining with his illness to bring about his death. The Romans, still mindful of their earlier reverse, did not force their way in until the 23rd of the same month. Titus, who had by now arrived, in his anger at the blow the Romans had suffered in his absence, picked out 200 cavalry, together with a body of infantry, and entered the city quietly. When he had made his way in, the sentries, noticing him, rushed to arms with a shout, and word of the breach quickly spread to those inside as well. Some snatched up their children and wives, dragging them along and fled up toward the citadel, wailing and crying. Others, running straight into Titus, fell without a pause, and those who, in their confusion, were prevented from reaching the summit, stumbled instead into the Roman guard posts. On every side rose the endless groaning of the dying, and blood ran down the slope until it flooded the whole city. Vespasian now brought his entire force in to reinforce the men chasing those fleeing toward the citadel. The summit was rocky on every side and hard to climb, rising to an immense height and everywhere hemmed in and cut across by ravines of unfathomable depth. There the Jews harassed the men climbing up with missiles of every kind and by rolling down boulders on them, while they themselves, by virtue of the height, were hard to reach with any weapon in return. But then, against them, there arose a sudden storm sent by God for their destruction, one that carried the Romans in shouting, while those who ran into Titus's path fell without ceasing, and those who were kept from scrambling up to the peak were driven by sheer helplessness down onto the Roman guard posts. Everywhere the groaning of the dying was endless, and blood, pouring down the slope, drowned the whole city. Vespasian brought up his whole force to support the men chasing the fugitives up to the citadel. The peak itself was rocky on every side and hard to climb, rising to an immense height and hemmed in all around by ravines that fell away into the depths. There the Jews harassed the men climbing toward them with missiles of every kind, and especially by rolling down boulders. They themselves, because of the height, were hard for any missile to reach. Then, to their ruin, a violent and seemingly supernatural gale struck head-on, carrying the Romans' missiles into them while turning their own aside and sweeping them off course. Because of the force of the wind, the defenders could get no footing to stand on the cliff edges, having nothing steady to hold to, nor could they even see the men climbing up. So the Romans pressed on upward, and once they had surrounded them, some they cut down before they could defend themselves, others while they still held out their hands in surrender. And the memory of all they had lost in the first assault fanned their fury against everyone alike. Giving up all hope of survival, most of the people, gathering up their children and wives around them, flung themselves over the cliff into the ravine below the citadel, which was extremely deep at that point. As it turned out, the fury the Romans vented on them proved gentler than the despair the captured people inflicted on themselves. Some 4,000 were slaughtered by Roman hands, but more than 5,000 were found to have thrown themselves down. Of all the women, none survived except two, the daughters of a sister of Philip, Philip himself being a distinguished man who had served as tetrarch under King Agrippa. They survived because they escaped notice during the massacre that followed the city's fall. For at that time, not even infants were spared, many of them being repeatedly seized and hurled from the citadel. So Gamla was taken on the 23rd of the month Hyperbarateos, the revolt there having begun on the 24th of Gorpiaos. Only Gischala, a small town in Galilee, still remained unconquered. Most of its population wanted peace. They were mostly farmers who depended entirely on hopes for their harvests, but no small band of bandits had infiltrated among them, and some of the townspeople joined in their sickness. The man who drove them into revolt and organized them was the son of a certain Laius, John, a cunning man of the most shifting character, quick to hope for great things and clever at achieving what he hoped for, and plainly devoted to war as a path to power. Under him, the rebellious element in Gischala had been arrayed, and because of these men, the common people, who might well have sent envoys about surrender, instead awaited the Roman advance as if war were still their lot. Against them, Vespasian sent Titus with 1,000 cavalry, while he withdrew the 10th legion to Scythopolis. He himself, with the two remaining legions, returned to Caesarea, giving the men rest from their continual exertions and expecting that, thanks to the abundance of the cities, both their bodies and their spirit would be built back up for the struggles still to come. For he foresaw no small labor still awaiting him at Jerusalem, since that city was the capital and stood over the whole nation, and into it were streaming all who were fleeing the war. Its natural strength, together with the construction of its walls, created anxiety enough on its own, and he judged the spirit and daring of its men, even apart from the walls, hard to deal with. For this reason, he kept training his soldiers like athletes preparing for a contest. When Titus rode up to Gischala, it would have been easy to take the city by immediate assault, but he knew that if it were taken by force, the soldiers would slaughter the population without restraint. He was already sated with killing, and he pitied the thought of the greater part of the innocent perishing indiscriminately along with the guilty. So he preferred to bring the city over by terms. And indeed, as the wall was crowded with men, most of them from the corrupted rebel band, he told them he was astonished. On what did they rely, being the only ones left still bearing arms against Rome after every other city had fallen, when they had seen far stronger cities overthrown by a single assault, while those who had trusted in Rome's pledge of good faith now enjoyed their own property in safety? A pledge he was even now extending to them, bearing no grudge for their obstinacy. Hope of freedom, he said, was forgivable, but persistence when it was hopeless was not. For if they would not be won over by generous words and pledges of good faith, they would soon feel the full weight of Roman arms without mercy, and it would very quickly become clear that their wall, in which alone among the Galileans they placed such confident trust, would buckle under Roman siege engines, proving them stubborn captives. To this, the ordinary townspeople had no chance to reply, nor even to go up onto the wall, for the whole of it had already been seized in advance by the bandits, and men stood guard at the gates so that no one could go out to the negotiations or let any of the cavalry into the city. John himself replied that he welcomed the terms and would either persuade or compel those who refused them. But he asked that Titus grant that one day, for it was the Sabbath, out of respect for the law of the Jews, under which it was as forbidden for them to take up arms as it was to conclude a treaty of peace. Nor were the Romans ignorant, he said, that the whole cycle of the Sabbath was for them a day free from all work, and that to violate it was no less an impiety for the one who compelled the violation than for those compelled to commit it. And no harm at all, he said, would come to Titus from this postponement. For what could anyone plan to do by night beyond flight, when it was open to him to surround the town with his camp and keep watch? It would be a great gain for them not to transgress any of their ancestral customs, and it befitted one who was granting unexpected peace to those he was sparing to respect their laws as well. With such arguments he outwitted Titus, aiming not so much at the Sabbath as at his own survival. For he feared that if the city were taken at once, he would be caught inside it, and his only hope of life lay in escaping by night. It was, then, God's own doing, God who was preserving John for the destruction of Jerusalem. Not only that Titus was persuaded by the pretext of the postponement, but also that he pitched camp farther from the city, near Cadassa, an inland village of the Tyrians, strong and always full of hatred and hostility toward the Galileans because of its large population, a hostility that its natural strength only encouraged the more. During the night, when John saw no Roman guard posted around the city, he seized the moment and fled toward Jerusalem, taking with him not only the armed men around him, but also a great many of the less active townspeople, together with their families. Up to about 20 stads it was possible for him, hard pressed as he was by fear of capture and of death, to bring along with him the crowd of women and children, but beyond that point they were left behind, and the wailing of those left to fend for themselves was terrible. For the farther each person's own family fell behind, the nearer they imagined the enemy to be, and thinking the men who would take them captive were already upon them, they were struck with terror, and turned at the mere sound made by one another's running, as though those they were fleeing were already there. Many of them stumbled off the road entirely, and around the highway many were crushed in the rivalry of those pressing ahead of one another. Pitiful was the destruction of the women and children, and some, taking heart, called out with wailing cries to their husbands and kinsmen to wait for them. But John's own order prevailed as he shouted to them to save themselves and take refuge wherever they could, since they would also be able there to avenge those left behind should the Romans seize them. So the mass of fugitives scattered, each according to their own strength or speed. Titus, when day came, arrived at the wall to conclude the agreement. The people opened the gates to him, and coming out with their families, they acclaimed him as a benefactor who had freed the city from siege. For they revealed at once John's flight, and begged him to spare them and, entering the city, to punish those revolutionaries who remained behind. He, setting the people's petitions in second place for the moment, sent a detachment of cavalry in pursuit of John. They did not overtake him. He had already made his escape into Jerusalem. But of those who had fled with him, they killed some 6,000, and rounded up and brought back women and children, numbering close to 3,000. Titus was vexed that he had not been able to punish John at once for his deception. But having in the great number of captives and the slain a sufficient consolation for his frustrated anger, he entered the city amid acclamations, and after ordering his soldiers to pull down a small part of the wall, as a token that it had been taken by right of conquest, he restrained those who were stirring up trouble in the city by threats rather than punishment. For he saw that many, out of personal hatreds and private quarrels, would denounce the innocent as guilty if he set out to distinguish those deserving punishment. It was better, he judged, to leave the guilty man hanging in suspense and fear than to destroy along with him someone who did not deserve it. For the guilty man might perhaps even be brought to his senses by fear of punishment, out of respect for the pardon granted for what was past, whereas a punishment inflicted on someone already destroyed could never be undone. Still, he secured the city with a garrison, by which he meant to hold the revolutionaries in check and leave the peace-loving citizens more confident. So all of Galilee was conquered, after costing the Romans much hard toil on their way toward Jerusalem. As John made his entrance, the whole population poured out, and around each of the men who had escaped with him a vast crowd gathered, asking after news of the disasters abroad. Their still heaving, gasping breath betrayed the desperation of their flight, yet even in their misery they boasted, claiming they had not fled the Romans, but had come to fight them from a position of safety. For it was senseless and useless, they said, to risk their lives recklessly for Gischala and other weak little towns, when they ought instead to husband their weapons and their strength for the capital and guard it together. In saying this, they were hinting at the fall of Gischala, and most people understood their so-called dignified withdrawal for what it really was, flight. But when word of what had happened to the captives was heard, no small confusion seized the population, and they drew heavy conclusions about their own coming ruin from it. John himself was not much abashed by the losses. Going around to each group, he spurred them on to war with hopes, making Roman strength out to be weak and exaggerating his own force, and mocking the ignorance of those inexperienced in warfare, claiming that not even if the Romans grew wings could they ever get over the wall of Jerusalem. They who had struggled so hard around the villages of Galilee and worn out their siege engines against the walls there. By such talk, most of the young men were further corrupted and roused for war, while among the sober and the old there was not one who, foreseeing what was coming, did not already mourn as though the city were as good as lost. So the populace was in such confusion, while the population of the countryside had already split off from the factional strife within Jerusalem even before this. For Titus went from Gischala to Caesarea, and Vespasian went from Caesarea to Jamnia and Azotus, brought both under his control, installed garrisons in them, and returned bringing with him a great number of those who had come over willingly to the Roman side. In every city there arose turmoil and civil war, for as soon as men had breathing room from the Romans, they turned their hands against each other. There was bitter strife between those in love with war and those who longed for peace. First, the spirit of rivalry took hold within households among people once of one mind, then dearest friends, growing estranged from one another, and each gathering to those who shared his own choice, at last stood arrayed against each other in whole factions. Faction was everywhere, and the revolutionary element eager for arms got the upper hand over the age and prudence of their elders through sheer youth and daring. At first, each group turned to plundering the local inhabitants, then, organizing themselves into companies to banditry throughout the countryside, until in cruelty and lawlessness they were no different from the Romans toward their own countrymen, and being plundered by Romans came to seem, to the victims, far the lighter fate. The garrisons in the cities, partly from reluctance to expose themselves to hardship and partly from hatred of the nation, gave little or no help to those being wronged, until, glutted with plunder from the countryside, the chief bandits from every band gathered together, and, having become a single mass of villainy, infiltrated into Jerusalem, a city with no commander-in-chief, and one that, by ancestral custom, admitted without question any one of its own people. At a time when everyone supposed that all who were pouring in came as allies out of goodwill. This, quite apart from the factional strife, later helped drown the city, for the useless and idle crowd used up in advance the supplies that might have sustained the fighting men, and thereby brought upon themselves, in addition to the war, factional strife, and famine as well. Other bandits, too, came in from the countryside into the city, and joining forces with those already inside and becoming still more dangerous, no longer left off any atrocity. They did not confine their daring to plunder and robbery, but went as far as murder, not by night or in secret or against random victims, but openly, in broad daylight, and beginning with the most eminent men. The first they seized was Antipas, a man of royal blood and one of the most powerful men in the city, trusted enough to have charge of the public treasury. Him they arrested and imprisoned. After him, they seized a certain Levias, one of the notables, and Sypha's son of Arrogetes, whose family was likewise of royal blood, and who was reckoned among the leading men of the countryside. A terrible panic gripped the population, and, as though the city had already been taken by an enemy in war, each person clung only to his own individual safety. But the chains of those they had seized were not enough for them, nor did they think it safe to keep such powerful men under guard for long. For their households, they reasoned, being far from lacking in numbers, were quite capable of striking back in their defense, and moreover the populace itself might well rise up if stirred by such lawlessness. So they resolved to kill them, and sent a certain John, the most ready of their number for murder, who was called Son of Dorcas in the local tongue. With 10 men he came together into the prison and, swords drawn, butchered the prisoners there. For so great a crime they told great lies, inventing pretexts. They claimed the men had been negotiating with the Romans about surrendering Jerusalem, and that they had killed traitors to the common freedom, altogether boasting of their crimes, as though they had become the city's benefactors and saviors. Matters came to such a pitch that the people sank into abject humiliation and terror, while these men rose to such a pitch of madness that even the election of the high priests lay in their hands. They made void the family lines from which, by hereditary succession, the high priests had always been appointed, and installed men obscure and low-born so as to have accomplices in their impieties. For men who had come by the highest office undeservedly were bound to obey those who had given it to them. And they set at odds the men in authority too, with all manner of schemes and slanders, seizing their opportunity in the rivalries the leading men engaged in among themselves as they tried to restrain them, until, gorged past all measure on crimes against men, they turned their outrage even against what was sacred, and with feet still defiled walked into the holy place. When the populace at last began to rise up against them, for the eldest of the chief priests, Ananus, a man of the greatest good sense, was urging them on, and perhaps, and would have saved the city, had he escaped the conspirators' hands. But they made the temple of God their own fortress and their refuge from the people's uprisings, and the sanctuary became their tyrant's den. Mockery mixed with these horrors, more painful still than the acts themselves. Testing the people's terror and gauging their own strength, they undertook to fill the high priesthood by lot, though the succession to that office ran, as we have said, by family line. The pretext for their scheme was an ancient custom, on the ground that the high priesthood had once, long ago, been filled by lot. But the truth of it was the overthrow of a more binding law, a device by which men installed officers of their own through themselves, for the sake of power. So they summoned one of the priestly clans, called Eniachin, and cast lots for a high priest. By chance the lot fell on the very man whose choice most exposed their lawlessness. One Phani by name, son of Samuel, of the village of Aphtha, a man not only unconnected with the high priestly line, but who, out of sheer rusticity, did not even clearly know what the high priesthood was. They dragged him from the countryside against his will and dressed him up, as if for a part on a stage, in a mask not his own, putting the sacred vestments on him and instructing him, as the occasion demanded, in what he had to do. To them, this monstrous impiety was a joke and a game. But the other priests, watching from a distance as the law was mocked, were moved to tears and lamented the destruction of the sacred honors. This outrage the people would not endure, but rose as one man, as if to overthrow a tyranny. Indeed, those who seemed to stand foremost among them, Gorion son of Joseph and Simeon son of Gamaliel, stirred them up, both in full assemblies and by going about privately to each man, urging that at last they take vengeance on these destroyers of freedom and cleanse the sanctuary of men of blood. And the most respected of the high priests, Jesus son of Gamalas, and Ananus son of Ananus, in their meetings repeatedly reproached the people for their sluggishness and roused them against the zealots. For this was the name these men had given themselves, as though for admirable pursuits, rather than because they had rivaled, and outdone, the worst deeds ever done. Now when the people had gathered in assembly, and all were indignant at the seizure of the sanctuary, at the plundering, and at the killings, but had not yet been roused to strike back, since they judged rightly that the zealots would be hard to overcome, Ananus stood up among them, and looking many times toward the temple, his eyes filling with tears, said, "It would have been good for me to have died before I saw the house of God burdened with such abominations, and its untrodden, holy places crowded with the feet of murderers. Yet here I stand, wearing the high priest's robe and bearing the most honored of all revered titles, still alive, still clinging to life, unwilling even for my old age's sake to accept a glorious death, if indeed I must die alone, giving up, as if in some wilderness, only my own life for God. For what is the good of living among a people numb to its own disasters, among men who have lost all power to feel what is being done to them with their own hands? You let yourselves be robbed and say nothing. You are beaten and stay silent. No one so much as groans aloud for the murdered. Oh, the bitterness of this tyranny! But why do I blame the tyrants? Were they not nursed by you, by your own longsuffering? Was it not you who, by overlooking the first conspirators while they were still few, made them many, and who, staying quiet while they armed, turned those very weapons against yourselves, when you ought to have crushed their first stirrings, back when they were only hurling abuse at their kinsmen? Instead, you paid no heed, and so spurred these criminals on to plunder, and when houses were being sacked, no one said a word. So at last they seized the very owners of those houses, and as they were dragged through the middle of the city, no one came to their aid. Others they tortured in chains, men you yourselves had betrayed. I will not say how many, or who they were, but no one helped those in bonds, uncharged and untried. It followed naturally that we should see the same men murdered. We watched even that, like a flock of dumb animals always losing its finest victim to the slaughter, and not one of you so much as raised his voice, let alone his hand. Bear it then, go on bearing it, watching the holy things trampled underfoot, having set every rung of this ladder of crime beneath these godless men's feet yourselves, and do not now balk at how high they have climbed. For indeed, even now, they would certainly have gone further still, had they had anything greater left to destroy among the holy things. The strongest part of the city is already in their grip. Let the temple now be called a citadel, or a fortress, if you will. With such a tyranny entrenched over you, with your enemies looking down on you from the height, what are you deliberating, and on what do you pin your hopes? Will you wait for the Romans to come and rescue our holy places for us? Have things truly come to such a pass for the city that even our enemies should have to pity us? Will you not rise up, most wretched of men, and, turning to face the blows, a thing one can see even in wild beasts, defend yourselves against those who strike you? Will you not, each of you, call to mind your own private disasters, and, setting what you have suffered before your eyes, sharpen your resolve at last to strike back? Has the most precious and most natural of all passions died in you, the love of freedom? Have we become lovers of slavery and of masters, as if we had inherited submission from our forefathers? Yet they fought many great wars for their self-rule, and yielded neither to the power of Egypt nor to that of the Medes rather than do as they were commanded. But why speak of our forefathers? Even this present war against the Romans, I will not stop to argue whether it serves us or the reverse. What pretext does it have, if not freedom? And shall we, who could not endure the masters of the whole world, put up with tyrants of our own race? And yet, to submit to outsiders one might set down to a fortune that has once defeated us, but to give way to wicked men of our own house is the mark of the base, and of men who choose their servitude. And since I have once mentioned the Romans, I will not hide from you a thought that came to me in the middle of this speech and turned my mind, that even if we should fall under their power, though may that trial never come to pass, we could suffer nothing harsher than what these men here have already done to us. Is it not enough to make one weep, to see the Romans' own offerings standing in the temple, while men of our own blood have stripped its spoils and destroyed the nobility of our mother city, and have murdered men whom even the Romans, had they been the victors, would have spared? The Romans have never once crossed the boundary set for the profane, nor transgressed a single one of our sacred customs. they have shuddered even at a distance before the holy precincts. Yet men born in this very land, raised under our own customs, and called Jews, walk about in the midst of the holy places with hands still warm from the blood of their own countrymen. Does anyone, then, fear a foreign war, when set beside enemies within our own walls who are far more moderate than we ourselves? Indeed, if names must be fitted honestly to facts, one might well find that the Romans are the guarantors of our laws, and the enemy is within. But that the plotters against our freedom deserve utter destruction, and that no punishment one could devise would match their deeds, I think you have all come here already convinced, roused to act against them by your own sufferings even before my words. Perhaps many of you are alarmed at their numbers, their daring, and further at the advantage their position gives them. But all this arose, as it were, out of your own neglect, and will only grow if you delay further still. For their numbers swell daily, as every villain deserts to join his like, and nothing so far has checked their daring, holding as they do the higher ground, and they will use it, and with preparation too, if we give them time. But believe me, if we press upon them, their own conscience will make them the more cowed, and reflection will strip away the advantage of their height. Perhaps the divine power, once outraged, will turn their own missiles back upon them, and these impious men will be destroyed by their own weapons. Let them only see us before them, and they are already undone. And it is a fine thing, even where some danger attends it, to die at the sacred gates, and to give up one's life, if not for wife and children, then for God and for the holy things. I myself will lead you, in counsel and in arm alike, and you will find no plan wanting from me for your safety, nor will you see me sparing my own body. With these words, Ananus roused the people against the zealots, well aware that they were already hard to overcome, given their numbers, their youth, and their high spirit, and still more because of their guilty conscience for what they had done, for he knew they would never yield, hoping for no ultimate pardon for their crimes. Even so, he chose to suffer anything at all rather than stand by, while the state fell into such confusion. The people shouted for him to lead them against those he had denounced, and each man stood ready to be first into danger. While Ananus was enrolling and arraying the men fit for battle, the zealots learned of the undertaking, for informants brought them word of everything the people were doing, and, enraged, burst out of the temple in a body and by companies, sparing none they came upon. Ananus quickly gathered the populace, who outnumbered the zealots but fell short of them in arms and in discipline. On both sides, eagerness made up what was lacking. The men from the city had taken up an anger stronger than any weapon, while those from the temple brought a daring that surpassed any numbers. The one side supposed the city unlivable unless they cut the brigands out of it. The zealots supposed that, if they failed to prevail, no punishment would be spared them. So, driven by their passions, they clashed, at first, in the city and before the temple, hurling stones at one another and shooting missiles from a distance. But once either side broke and fled, the victors turned to their swords. Slaughter was great on both sides, and the wounded were many. The people's fallen were carried off to their homes by their kinsmen, but any zealot who was struck went up into the temple and stained the holy pavement with his blood, so that one might truly say it was their own blood that defiled the sanctuary. In these skirmishes, it was the brigands, always sallying out and back, who kept the upper hand. But the people, growing angrier and ever more numerous, reproaching those who gave ground and, pressing from behind, giving those who turned no room to retreat, threw their whole weight against the enemy. When the zealots could no longer hold against that force and began, little by little, to fall back into the temple, Ananus and his men burst in along with them. Panic fell on the zealots at the loss of the outer court, and fleeing into the inner precinct, they quickly barred the gates. Ananus decided against storming the sacred gates, not least because the defenders were hurling missiles down from above, and besides, he judged it unlawful to bring the people in, even in victory, without their having first undergone purification. So he chose about 6,000 armed men by lot from the whole body and posted them as guards along the porticos. Others relieved these in rotation, and every man was bound to take his turn on watch in his proper order. Though many men of rank, released by those in command, hired poorer men to stand guard duty in their place. The ruin of all these men was brought about by John, whom we have said fled from Jeshala, a most treacherous man, carrying in his heart a terrible passion for tyranny, who had long been plotting from a distance against the state of affairs. And now, pretending to hold the people's views, he went about with Ananus, joining the leading men in council both by day and by night as they made their rounds of the guard posts, but reported their secrets to the zealots, so that every plan of the people, before it was even properly settled, became known to their enemies through him. To avoid falling under suspicion, he lavished excessive attentions on Ananus and the leaders of the people. But his very eagerness worked against him. His groundless flattery only made him the more suspected, and his being everywhere, uninvited, gave the impression that he was betraying their secrets. For they saw that the enemy was aware of everything they planned, and no one seemed a more likely source for such reports than John. It was not easy to be rid of him, since he was a capable man in wickedness, and besides, no obscure figure, having also armed and attached to himself many of the council's own members. So instead they resolved to bind him by oaths to goodwill. John readily swore that he would be well disposed to the people, that he would betray to their enemies neither counsel nor action, and that he would join in putting down the aggressors, by hand and by counsel alike. Ananus and his party, trusting these oaths, now admitted him to their deliberations without suspicion, and even sent him as an envoy to the zealots to discuss terms, for they were anxious, above all, that the sanctuary not be defiled through their own doing, and that none of their countrymen should fall within it. But John, exactly as he had sworn to the zealots to favor them and not act against them, went inside, and, standing in their midst, declared that he had many times put himself at risk on their behalf, so that they should remain ignorant of none of the secret plans that Ananus and his party had made against them, and that now he and all of them together were courting the gravest danger, unless some more than human help should come to their aid. For Ananus, he said, meant to delay no longer. He had already persuaded the people to send envoys to Vespasian, urging him to come at once and take the city, and had proclaimed a day of purification against them for the following day, so that the people might close with them either by entering under cover of the right or by force. He said he could not see how much longer they could hold out on guard, or how they could stand in battle against so many. He added that he himself had been sent, by God's providence, as their envoy to discuss these terms, Ananus was offering only so that he might fall upon them the less suspecting. They must therefore either plead for their lives with the guards in words, or procure some help from outside. For those who warmed themselves with hope of pardon, should they be overpowered, had forgotten their own crimes, or supposed that as soon as the wrongdoers repented, their victims must at once be reconciled to them. But wronged men, he said, often come to hate their wrongdoers all the more, and repentance, while for the wronged their anger grows harsher once they have the power to indulge it. And lying in wait for them were the friends and kinsmen of the dead, and a populace so vast, and so enraged over the overthrow of the laws and courts that even if some small part of it were inclined to pity, that part would be swallowed up by the much greater number raging in fury. Such were the various threats John heaped up all at once to intimidate them, though he did not dare speak openly of help from outside, he only hinted at the Idumeans. And to provoke the leaders of the zealots individually as well, he accused Ananus of savagery and claimed he was threatening them by name. Among them was Eleazar son of Jen, who indeed seemed the most capable of the group both at grasping what needed to be done and at carrying it out, and a certain Zacharias son of Amphicalius, both of priestly descent. These two, on top of the general threats, heard also of threats made against themselves in particular, and further that Ananus's faction, in securing power for itself, was calling in the Romans, for John had invented this charge too. For a long while they were at a loss what to do, caught in so sudden a crisis. The people, they were told, were preparing to attack them before long, while the very speed of the plot against them had cut off any hope of outside help, since everything would be done to them before their allies even learned of it. Even so, they decided to call in the Idumeans. They wrote a brief letter, claiming that Ananus was betraying the capital to the Romans after deceiving the people, that they themselves had revolted for the sake of freedom and were now held under guard in the temple, and that only a little time remained to decide their fate. Unless the Idumeans came quickly to help, they themselves would fall to Ananus and his allies, and the city would fall to the Romans first. They charged the messengers to say most of this by word of mouth to the Idumean leaders. Two vigorous men were chosen for the errand, capable speakers and persuasive in argument, and more useful still, remarkably swift on their feet. For they knew the Idumeans would need no persuading, being a turbulent and undisciplined people, always primed for upheaval and delighting in change, stirred to arms by the slightest flattery from those in need, and rushing to battle as though hurrying to a festival. Speed was essential, and the two men sent, sparing no effort, both happened to be named Ananias. They duly reached the Idumean leaders. The Idumeans, stunned by the letter and by what the messengers reported, ran through the nation as though possessed, proclaiming the call to arms. The mass mustered faster than the summons could reach them, and all seized their weapons as though fighting for the freedom of the capital itself. Organized into 20,000 men, they marched on Jerusalem under four commanders: John, James son of Sosas, and with them Simon son of Thacias and Phineas son of Clusoth. Ananias knew nothing of the messenger's departure, any more than the guards did, but the Idumeans' approach did not escape him. Forewarned, he shut the gates against them and kept the walls under close guard. Still, he did not decide on outright war with them, but chose to persuade them with words before resorting to arms. Jesus, the senior chief priest after Ananias, took his stand on the tower facing them and spoke. "Many and varied troubles have gripped this city, but in none of them have I marveled at fortune as I do now, that it should even cooperate with the wicked in doing the unthinkable. Here you stand, ready to defend the most depraved of men against us, with as much eagerness as would have suited an advance against barbarians answering the capital's own call. Had I seen your ranks made up of men resembling those who summoned you, I would not think your zeal unreasonable. Nothing binds goodwill so firmly as kinship of character. But examine them one by one, and each will be found to deserve 1,000 deaths. They are the dregs and refuse of the whole city, men who squandered their own estates and trained their madness beforehand in the villages and towns around us, and finally crept unnoticed into the holy city itself, bandits who, through the sheer excess of their crimes, defile even the ground that must not be profaned. You can see them now, drinking themselves senseless on holy things without a shred of fear, and gorging their insatiable bellies on the spoils of the murdered. Your own numbers and the splendor of your weapons would suit a summons from the capital to a shared council, as allies against foreigners. What is one to call this but the mockery of fortune, when a whole armed nation is seen locking shields with a gang of criminals? For a long time I have wondered what could have stirred you so suddenly. Surely no one takes up full armor without grave cause, and against kinsmen at that. But when we heard talk of Romans and treachery, words some of you were just now shouting, and that you had come to liberate the capital, we marveled, more than at any of their other outrages, at these villains' brazen invention. Men naturally devoted to freedom, and for that very reason most eager to fight foreign enemies, could be roused against us in no other way than by fabricating a story of betrayed freedom. But you at least ought to weigh who is making these accusations, and against whom, and gather the truth not from invented words but from the plain facts. What could we possibly have suffered that would make us sell ourselves to the Romans now, when it was open to us either never to have revolted in the first place, or, having revolted, to come over to them quickly while the country around us still stood unravaged? As it is, even if we wish to make terms, it would not be easy, since the fall of Galilee has made the Romans contemptuous of us, and it would bring us a shame worse than death to court them now that they are already so near. For my own part, I would rather have peace than death, but once war is joined and I have taken the field, I would choose a glorious death over life as a captive. Do they claim that we, the leaders of the people, sent secretly to the Romans, or that the people voted it openly? If it was we, let them name the friends who were sent, the servants who carried out the betrayal. Was anyone caught leaving the city, seized on his return? Have any letters been intercepted? How is it that so many fellow citizens, with whom we mingle at every hour, never noticed, while the few men under guard, who cannot even leave the temple for the city, somehow learned what was being done in secret across the countryside? They have only just discovered it, now that punishment for their own crimes is due. While they went unafraid themselves, was any one of us ever suspected as a traitor? And if they lay the blame on the people, surely the people deliberated in the open, and no one stayed away from the assembly, so the report would have reached you all the sooner and more plainly. And besides, should envoys not have been sent once such terms were voted? Who was appointed? Let them say. No, this is merely the pretext of men facing a painful death, trying to deflect punishments already close at hand. For even if the city's betrayal had truly been fated, only these same slanderers would have dared it, men whose reckless crimes lack only one thing, betrayal. But since you are here, weapons in hand, the most just course for you is to defend the capital and help destroy these tyrants who have overturned the courts, men who have trampled the laws and pronounced judgment at the point of their own swords. They have dragged men of distinction, wholly uncharged, out of the middle of the marketplace, bound and abused them, and put them to death without allowing them so much as a word in their own defense. You may go inside, not under the laws of war, and see with your own eyes the proof of what I say. Houses stripped bare by their plunder, the wives and children of the slain dressed in mourning black, wailing and lamentation throughout the entire city. There is no one who has not tasted the assault of these godless men. They have run so far into madness that they have carried their bandits' daring not only from the countryside and outlying towns onto the face and head of the whole nation, but from the city itself into the temple. That has become their base and refuge, the storehouse of their preparations against us. The place revered by the whole world, honored even by foreigners at the ends of the earth by reputation alone, is trampled by the beasts bred here. Already, in their desperation, they boast of setting people against people and city against city, and levying war against the nation from its own vitals. In return for this, the finest and most fitting course, as I have said, is for you to join in destroying these villains, and to avenge the very deception by which they dared call allies those they ought instead to fear as avengers. But if you shrink from such accusations, then at least you may lay down your arms, enter the city as kinsmen would, and take the middle ground between ally and enemy by becoming judges. Consider, though, how much they stand to gain, men who granted not even a hearing to the uncharged, if they are tried by you on charges this well established and this grave. Let them at least receive that favor from your arrival. But if you think it right neither to share our indignation nor to sit in judgment, there remains a third course. Leave both sides be, neither trespassing on our misfortune nor joining the plotters against the capital. Even if you deeply suspect that some have indeed dealt with the Romans, you can watch the approaches yourselves, and if any of these charges is ever proven in fact, come then and guard the capital and punish the guilty once they are caught, for the enemy could hardly outrun you, camped as you would be so close to the city. But if none of this strikes you as fair or reasonable, then do not be surprised at the bars on our gates, so long as you bear arms. Such were the words of Jesus. But the mass of the Idumeans paid him no heed. They were enraged that entry was not granted them at once, and their generals bristled at being told to lay down their arms, taking it as a mark of captivity to be ordered by anyone to throw down their weapons. Simon, son of Cathla, one of the commanders, with difficulty quieted the uproar among his own men, then stood where the chief priests could hear him and spoke. I no longer wonder that the champions of freedom are kept under guard in the temple, when some men are already shutting even the whole nation out of its own common city, preparing, it seems, to receive the Romans, perhaps even to garland the gates for them, while they lecture the Idumeans from the towers and order them to throw down the arms they carry for freedom's sake. Distrusting their own kinsmen with the guarding of the capital, they make these very kinsmen judges of their quarrels, and while accusing some of killing without trial, they themselves condemn the whole nation to disgrace. The city thrown open to every foreigner for worship, you now wall off from your own people. We were indeed in a great hurry for bloodshed, rushing to make war on our own countrymen. We, who came here in haste for the very purpose of keeping you free. Such, it seems, are the wrongs you two have suffered at the hands of those under guard, and I suppose that is how you have gathered such plausible suspicions against them. And then, holding by force, inside the city, all who care for the common good, and shutting out with such insolent commands the very nations closest to you in kinship, you call yourselves the tyrannized, and you hang the name of tyranny on those you yourselves tyrannize. Who could stomach the irony of such words, set against the plain contradiction of the facts? Unless indeed it is the Idumeans who are shutting you out of the capital now, when it is you who bar them from their ancestral worship. One might justly blame the men besieged in the temple for this much. That having found the courage to punish the traitors, men you call distinguished and uncharged only because you shared in their guilt, they did not begin with you, and cut off in advance the most vital parts of this betrayal. But if they proved too gentle for what the moment required, then we, the Idumeans, will guard the house of God and fight for our common homeland, warding off as enemies both those who attack from outside and those who betray it from within. Here, before your walls, we will remain under arms, until the Romans grow weary of watching you, or until you come to your senses about freedom and change your minds. At these words, the mass of the Idumeans roared their approval, and Jesus withdrew, disheartened at seeing the Idumeans set on showing no restraint, and the city under attack from two sides at once. Yet the Idumeans themselves were far from easy in their minds. They were angered at the insult of being shut out of the city, and seeing that the zealots' strength, which they had believed so formidable, offered them no help at all, many of them grew troubled and regretted having come. But shame at turning back having accomplished nothing overcame their regret, and so they stayed where they were, camped miserably before the wall. That night an overwhelming storm broke, violent winds together with the heaviest downpours, unbroken lightning, dreadful thunder, and the monstrous roar of the earth as it shook. It was plain that this convulsion of the whole natural order portended ruin for mankind, and no one could suppose these portents the product of some ordinary mischance. Both the Idumeans and the people within the city drew the very same conclusion from it, though in opposite directions. The one side thought God was angry at their expedition and that they could not escape punishment for bearing arms against the capital. The other, Ananus's party, thought they had won without a battle, and that God himself was fighting on their behalf. But they proved poor judges of what was to come, and in reading omens against their enemies, they were unwittingly foretelling what was about to happen to their own side. For the Idumeans, huddling their bodies together and locking their shields over their heads, suffered comparatively little from the rains, while the zealots, tormented more on the Idumeans' account than by any danger of their own, met together to consider whether they could devise some way to help them. The more hot-headed among them favored forcing the guards at sword point, then bursting into the middle of the city and openly throwing the gates open to their allies, reasoning that the guards, thrown into confusion by the unexpected assault, would give way, especially since most of them were unarmed and untrained in war, and that the mass of the people in the city would be hard to rally, penned into their homes as they were by the storm. And even if some danger arose from it, they thought it right to risk anything rather than stand by while so great a host perished shamefully on their account. But the more level-headed among them rejected the use of force, seeing they saw that not only was their own guard at full strength, but the wall of the city was carefully watched too, because of the Idumeans. They supposed that Ananus was everywhere and inspected the watches at every hour. That was true on other nights, but on this one the watch was relaxed, not through any carelessness of Ananus, but so that he himself and the whole body of the guards might perish, fate directing the outcome. That night, as it wore on and the storm grew more violent, fate lulled the guards on the portico to sleep and put it into the zealots' minds to take up saws from the temple stores and cut through the bars of the gates. The noise of the wind and the continuous rolling of thunder helped them go undetected. Slipping unseen out of the temple, they came to the wall and, using the same saws, opened the gate on the Idumean side. At first the Idumeans were thrown into confusion, supposing Ananus's men were attacking them, and every man's hand went to his sword to defend himself. But they quickly recognized who had come and went in. Had they then turned loose on the city, nothing would have stopped the whole populace from being destroyed, so great was their fury. As it was, being eager above all to rescue the zealots from the siege, and being begged besides, by the men who had let them in, not to overlook them in the midst of such dangers, nor to bring a still harsher peril down on their own heads, since if the guards were captured, it would be easy for them to move against the city. But if they stirred up the city first, they would never afterward master the guards, for the guards would organize against them and block the approaches. The Idumeans agreed to this and went up through the city toward the temple, while the zealots, on tiptoe, watched eagerly for their arrival. When they came in, The zealots too took courage and came forward from the inner sanctuary.